Hey guys, popping in with a reminder to sign up for the GovHub newsletter. This weekly pop of politics is designed to share action items, resources, and quick links to civic engagement tools and topics directly to your inbox. Save it, share it, and sign up for a pinch of productive politics today by going to girlonthegov.com or visiting this episode's description.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Welcome back to Girl on the Gov, the podcast,
where we're shooting the shit with elected officials and candidates running for office to get to know the person beyond the politics.
Because politicians needed a rebrand.
Oh, welcome back to...
Oh, Discoland.
Discoland. This is everyone since the People's Princess, who's been licking me all day. Lucky dog. What I've learned from this is that I apparently just should be selling my foot pics on OnlyFans because clearly they are the taste of the town.
Ew.
I know. I know.
Unnecessary visual. I also I have a controversial take. I hate little dog licks. I hate little dog licks.
Here's the thing.
There's something about a little tongue. I can't. It's like close. It's almost as bad as like cat licks.
I don't know if I've ever been licked by a cat.
Well, cats have that like textured tongue.
So do it's they really? Like,
yeah.
Oh, huh. I will have to, next time I'm with Oliver, I will have to, he's not a licker. He's the only cat I know.
Yeah, well, that's probably this the best.
Yeah, I'm not. This one's just literally a foot licker. So I don't know what that, which, you know, I'm a people pleaser over here.
Yeah.
The People's Princess we're recording this on National Dog Day. So.
Oh yeah. Perfect. Cause I got Biggie here too. You got both of our special pups with us on this special day.
Also, do you think we look alike?
Yeah. I was going to say, it's like weird. You guys have the same hair color and everything. She's definitely a little blonder than you, but.
Rude. Pisco, did you hear that? Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to go sit in the sun later and then we'll see what happens. Okay. We're going to really go.
Squirt some lemon in there.
No, I really need to do that. Oh, she's running for it. Okay. Anyways, most importantly, why we are here. Let's see. Oh, we have this podcast, Girl on the Gov podcast, where we talk with really awesome candidates and elected officials. So in case you're new here, that's pretty much the story. But we also like dish the tea, and that's the 411. And some of the tea this week has to do with the DNC that kind of rhymed. It almost added a little thing to it. Didn't even mean to do it. But, you know, when geniuses are at work, wear your hard hats.
Yeah.
Something like that. Wear your camo hats.
The amount of camo at the DNC was... truly like my dream come true. Like I've been talking about this for so long. Like progressives need to take back camo. Camo was everywhere. It was like everyone made like the Waltz hats, Harris hats, dupes. And then like we made a hat that like had a different saying on it. And then there was Hotties for Harris camo shirts. And just like, oh, it was like a dream come true. I feel like I truly manifested it.
No, you literally did. And for that exact reason, I'm going to give you a list of things that we need to manifest because this clearly is your talent. Okay. So thing one, okay. Kamala Harris wins the presidency. Landslide. Okay.
Trifecta.
Right. There is a big and little dog in the White House combo. Okay. Manifesting that. So like a biggie and a disco.
Big brother, okay? Little sister. Yeah.
Exactly. We need that dynamic to happen. Third of all, we also need to manifest an interview with presidential stylist/makeup artist still. I know it's been on our list for a while. but I'm just dying to know. And I know.
I will say, I know someone who knows Kamala's stylist, but it's like very off the record. I don't think I could pull those strings.
Okay, well, we can manifest it. Anything else on the manifestation journal?
Yeah, a Beyonce Taylor Swift like inauguration day performance, because when I say that, like, whoever came up with these rumors that they were going to be at the DNC, there's like seriously a special place in hell for someone who like makes that rumor, because we were all so convinced one of them, perhaps even both of them, were going to come out. There was a Beyonce sound check too. It was so weird. Like, somebody was like performing one of her songs, and I was like, oh shit, like maybe it was just like a sound check and they had someone like step in and like do it for her. No, like, there's seriously a special place in hell for you if you started either or both of those rumors. Like, how dare you?
The amount of texts that I got in that day lead up, I wasn't even fucking there. Like, which cemented in my head, I was like, people really do think we are the Dumois of politics. Cause I was like, you think I know? Which I was like, honored, but also, really?
Yeah.
Honored, but lock and key with things. But no, that one we did not know. And that one we were like all tricked, saddened, disappointed, disheartened, but hearts were warmed with Kamala's iconic speech, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think it was a good speech. She definitely like pandered to the center a little bit, pandered to some like, you know, more conservative like states, which we have to win. So like necessary. But overall, like, I loved it. I loved the overall vibes of the DNC being there. It was like really, really special. And like to feel like the energy was like real, I think. And I don't know like what it felt like coming through TVs. I also like want to rewatch a lot of speeches. For a lot of people's speeches, when they had like their kind of like one-liners that were really like, woo, I couldn't hear. And so I'm like, there's so many like good moments I wanted to like rewatch. But generally, like, it was absolutely fucking electric in there. And it just like, it's quite literally an echo chamber. So like, I acknowledge that. But I think I also love like the comparison videos of like RNC, DNC. Like, it's just like the energy was palpable. And I don't know how it was felt externally, but like internally, it was like, wow. We're in a moment right now, and it was exciting.
Well, A, slay amazing all the things. I will say, like, I put, like, some asks out there to people. I was like, do people that especially have, like, a Republican relative, friend, like, even themselves, like, are you guys watching, like, the content? Are you watching the DNC? And pretty much everyone was saying yes, which I thought was really interesting, because I know, like, I really tuned out of the RNC. Like, I watched some of the clips of, you know, for like what we do and yada yada. But I was like, I just can't. So I was curious.
Are you
curious,
also watching
like,
the whole thing?
I was watching
like program and speeches started at like 5 or 5:30. Like, do you watch the whole thing?
Mm-mm. I was watching it like 8+ because I had like a million things for us to do work-wise. And then in addition to that, it's like, okay, like if I had plans, it's like, well, I'm still going to like go to that workout class or like go, like whatever it is. It also goes so late. Like, I was, like, literally, by the end of it, there was some meme I remember I sent you, and it was, like, literally this girl was, like, all frazzled, like literally, like,
that. Well, East Coast time, too, and we are Central time.
Yeah.
That's why these are the moments, too. I love Pacific time.
Yeah, you were good.
The State of the Union, we really get it for, like, our prime time. But Central time, it felt late. Like, it ended at, like, 11, and then you're, like, it takes forever to get out of there, and then you're going to bed by 1. But East Coast time, even worse.
I was pooped. I was tired for sure. And I was like, also because it's like screen time. So you're like, it's not just like, oh, you're like out late doing something. It's like, no, you're like staring at a screen and like, whatever.
I mean, sleepy.
Yeah. So one of those things, but we have a registered dogocrat over here now. So it's great. That was really the takeaway on that end. But I think, like, I will say in the city, like the energy definitely felt it. And I got a compliment on one of my dresses. Like, it was this really cute outfit from a girl wearing a Kamala shirt. So,
I mean, the merch,
the merch has been slaying.
I have a lot of merch here that I'm like, the merch was flowing and the merch is good. That's what's exciting too about this era. Like, the team within Kamala HQ, we love them. I think, I don't know who they are, but they're slaying with content and with just like merch. They're like with the times, you know?
Oh, for sure. Wait, okay. Give some insights. Like, what was like day in the life at the DNC? Like, Who did you see? What were like the wild, crazy things? You're like, holy shit, I cannot believe I saw that. Like, what's that? Yeah. Can be on the record.
Yeah. On the record, Day in the Life was like just chaos every day, but it was like really fun chaos. It was, you know, we were there with a lot of content creators, which like I'm sure we could go off for hours about this like content creator, like journalist drama, which I kind of look for.
But wait, can we go down that rabbit hole? Because that gives me an excuse to push our TikTok on it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, let's start there, I guess. So content creators, the DNC invited a lot of them. At my job, we brought some too. And overall, there was just like, there ended up being this kind of like, mostly caused by the journalist there, like this kind of like shit talking about like thinking that creators got like all the special treatment when they didn't really. The creator lounge had some chicken tenders and some drinks and coffee. Like, you know, like they acted like they were getting this like crazy treatment. Not the case. And then just, I think there's just an overall like misunderstanding and lack of, and just like lack of understanding or willing to understand from kind of traditional media and journalists who just don't understand like what creators do and who they are. And like how there's all these different like niches of content, and people have silly content, people have serious content, people have all these different things that they cover. And there's just kind of a disparaging of like what content creators do and the validity of like their work and their reach and their impact. And there's just, it was just interesting. It was interesting to see, to see that like clash a little bit. But I think overall the creators were like, they're just haters. They're just being haters. And the creators didn't really start anything. They were just like reacting to the kind of harsh criticism that like traditional media was pushing towards them.
That's such a weird vibe. I mean, I guess it's like, honestly, it's just like when people act that, like that, I feel like it's just like always jealousy. But like to your point, it's like, are you really jealous over chicken tenders? Like go to Wendy's, get the spicy nugs, like have a great time. Like I think... Yeah. Like to me, and this is like one of the, like the TikTok that I made on this was like, there's so much opportunity for collaboration, and actually that collaboration would keep some of these traditional media pieces alive so much more and like really bring them to the next level. If like they engage with content creators, like did a tour at like one of the studios with the content creators, had journalists do like cross training stuff. Like it's like each other could be its strength, and it's like, what's with
this? But it's also just like, everyone's allowed to have their own lane. I think that that's what they don't understand. I think it's like they were kind of upset that creators were lumped into this like press category.
Okay.
When it's like, I think there was criticisms from traditional media that they like weren't unbiased the way traditional journalists are. Mm-hmm. They don't have like the newsrooms fact checking and doing all of that. And it's like, yeah, but you're doing that, you know, like, and it's, and I think the DNC is inviting them. They're typically like uplifting the Democratic brand, which they're there to do, which like traditional media maybe isn't there to do that. Not that creators are necessarily just like completely void of facts, but it's just like, they're just, they, it's different. It's just a scarcity mindset. You know, you're just like, there's room for everyone. You know, there's, we can all do this. We're all doing different things. Let's all move together forward. Like, why are we, you know?
Yeah, no, that gives me the ick for sure. And it's just like weird. It's like there's so many things to be fighting about. Like this should not be one of them is sort of like the vibe. And also, too, it's like the bias. Like you can't tell me that MSNBC isn't biased. Like,
exactly. That's the other thing. Or like New York Times. New York Times mad. Why are you mad?
I mean, New York Times is mad about anything. They're like literally like I think each week they go, let's see how many more people we can have unsubscribe or cancel their subscriptions. Like, it's almost like a challenge. I'm like, guys, like, chill out.
Yeah, it was just like also, nitpicky and lame.
I also, to add to this too, it's like, you guys also have like actually the leg up. Like, if you're this reporter, like, so your hotel room is covered. Your flights out there are covered. Like, your meals out there are covered. Like, all of these things that content creators are paying out of pocket for as a majority, not all, like obviously some, but like as a majority, like that's costing content creators tons. Like that's like one of like the calculations I did where I was like, first of all, I don't know how to fly.
Yeah, you probably have healthcare. You probably have like benefits that your job provides you. Like these creators don't. So like there's
being give and takes treated so well. Like, oh no, like you have healthcare and they don't. Like let's just however, now I really want to be a chicken tender. So
The chicken tenders at the United Center were really, really good, I will say. Very salty. But I had another point I was going to make, but I completely forget what it was. But I'll go back into Day in the Life because we only have a few more minutes. But Day in the Life was like, we had a suite where we were like doing live streaming. V from Under the Desk News was like hosting those every day. We had surrogates coming in and out. It was just interesting because the way we came in, we came in through a press entrance because content creators were considered press. And so the people that I was just like walking by was fascinating. I mean, all of the surrogates were like in there too. So like all the congressmen, I saw so many people who were formerly on the show, which was exciting. But I also saw the likes of like Charlie Kirk, walked by him.
What was he doing there?
There, I mean, all of the like Fox Newsers, yeah, the, like, you know, conservative folks were there. Why do I forget her name every time? Kellyanne Conway walked by her, walked by this other Fox guy. It's just like, it's just so interesting. You're just like, there's Wolf, what's up? So it was just like crazy, those little moments of you just walking by people and you're like, oh, hey, or like random like celebrities or whatever. But it was a crazy experience that was really fun and chaotic. But and then there was like all the parties and the parties. I like literally probably went to 2 to 3 parties. Just like there's 100 happening at once, like before and after the convention. And my God, it's too much. But the one I will say that was like truly like the coolest event I've ever been to was Hotties for Harris, which the girlies over at Feminist put on with like Deja Fox. So it was like a kind of a creator forward party. It was incredible. Like all of those art pieces, like the couch, like I've sent you some of those pictures. Like that was, it just had all of this art, like mocking conservatism and like Republicans. And it was incredible. So yeah, that was like my really fast winded recap.
Iconic. Yeah. We'll probably be dissecting this for like weeks to come in like little tidbits, honestly, is like how I first say, but yeah, that.
And I'll have little memories like come back. I just, oh yeah.
It's hard when you like, it's just happened and you're like, mm-hmm. One, like exhausted. Two, it's just like hard to even like process in the moment. Like that's with like anything. You know what I mean? Like even if you like hang out with friends and you're like la 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 la, and then 2 days
later, I need to like journal or something. Friend. Yeah.
But we love a recap. We love a debrief. We love all the things. We'll continue to chat about it, obviously, and like all the little details. But you think about like who is, I think for like last question is, she's crying. I don't even know. Is this parenthood? I'm not for it.
That is parenthood.
Who is the weirdest person you saw and who is the... Okay, get down. I don't know why you want to get down. You eat all your food. Who is the weirdest person you saw? Like, just like, what the fuck? And who is the coolest person you saw that you're like, oh my God.
The weirdest person is probably Charlie Kirk. And to be honest, I like forgot what his name was. I was like, you're the face of that annoying guy who like goes on college campuses and talks shit to people. I'd say that's the weirdest. Another just like weird moment that wasn't like weird bad. It was just like weird funny. I went to the bathroom and on my way to the bathroom, like Stevie Wonder walks by me and I'm like, oh, Stevie. And then Stevie walks by and then right across the hall, who was like also just staring at Stevie, was young Sheldon. Yeah. I was like, what? I was like, this is just my walk to the bathroom at the DNC classic. But yeah, that was probably the weirdest, like funniest moment. I don't know. It's funny. I think there's like a probably 3 to 4 people on this earth that like I would actually be like starstruck by, or like
I know who they are.
And you know who they are. But for the most part, like everyone I saw, I was just like, okay, like I didn't feel the need to like get a picture or whatever.
Yeah.
So I've just like realized, and to be honest, it's probably in large part, especially political surrogates, like in large part thanks to the show, I'm just like, hey.
Okay, well, this is going to be the last thing, because I know we have to go. AKA intro. But did you see what Hailey Bieber's child's middle name is? It's yes. Blues.
It's of course Blues. I did.
And I was like, Max, you freak out. This is like the best day of her life. So I saw that and I think she knows. You guys are best friends. And sorry, Hamburner. And that basically, like, she was like, oh my God, I'm going to name my little baby after
I think that Madison just Blue. Means we're going to, yeah, we're going to, I'm going to be auntie one day.
So.
Yeah. But anyways,
before we jump, we have to introduce our guest.
Yeah, let's introduce our guest.
Like, hello. Our guest is Deborah Shigley, and she is running for State House in Georgia. So we talk all about that, what that race is like, what's happening, all the things. And so without further ado, here's Deborah.
Hey, it's Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of Lovesac and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Curious how successful people really made it? Tune in to hear from guests like Travis Mills, a true American hero, and Nate Checkitz, co-founder of Roan. We dive deep into their stories and lessons that shape them so you can skip the trial and error and get straight to the good stuff. You can find me wherever you get your podcasts. That's Let Me Save You 25 Years with Sean Nelson. Listen now.
Woo! Okay, we are hopping right into things with Deborah Shigley, who is running for a state house in Georgia, which talk about the state that is, it's not like the apple of people's eyes, it's literally like the peach of people's eyes, which I think is a much funner phrase, to be honest. And I'm so curious as to what made you decide to run, hop into this race. What's the full story? Give us the tea.
Well, thanks so much for having me on today, ladies. It's wonderful to be here with you. And yeah, I never thought I'd get into politics. So a little about my, I'm running for the state house here in Georgia. I'm in District 47, which if you know, have you heard of Fulton County?
Mm-hmm.
Fulton County, we know, we've heard it in the news because of various lawsuits and things like that. So most of my district is in Fulton County, the northern part of it. And then we also have a small piece of Cherokee County, which shoot to the north of that. So North Atlanta suburbs, it includes cities Alpharetta, Roswell, Mountain Park, and a couple others. And yeah, I had not thought I would get into politics, but as a mom of five kids, ensuring a bright future for them and knowing that in Georgia, while there are many wonderful things about it, we are going in the wrong direction on a lot of policies that are really important for our children's future, not the least of which is reproductive rights, supporting our public schools, et cetera. I decided to get into the arena.
Love it.
That is awesome.
I'm curious too, like, I feel like we got that little like geographical landscape of the district, but can you also give like the political landscape in terms of what you're running against and what the electorate's like and all of those details?
Yes. So this district is a suburban district, like many you probably have heard about on the news. The seat I'm running for has been held by a Republican for about 20 years. So it has been considered kind of a safe seat, right? It's been considered a safe seat, but the district has changed dramatically over that time. I mean, I myself used to live in Eastlake, Atlanta, back sort of closer to the city. And again, with the five kids, we moved up north because we need a little more space and breathing room. That happened mid-COVID, and we were just drawn to this incredible community. Interestingly, many other folks have moved into the area, and that has also caused a shift in the demographics. The blue of Atlanta is kind of moving outward, if you can sort of picture that geographically, and our district is kind of part of that. So to the extent that it's been held by a Republican for so long does not represent the changing demographics of the district. We have 15% of voters are new voters since 2020, which is a lot. That's definitely a dramatic shift, and they tend to be younger and they tend to be more diverse. So in terms of like the contours of the district, yeah. In 2020, Biden got, you know, a little over 46% of the vote, and Warnock 2022 got 48% of the vote. So, and it's trending 2.2% in the Dems' favor. So that's to say it is a rapidly changing district.
That is so exciting, though, to sort of see things evolve and also people sort of explore new areas. And I think obviously COVID had a lot of really horrible, horrendous effects. I mean, so many tragedies, but it has also put more people into politics and gotten people more involved. And also like people sort of try, you know, live in new places. And I think that's been such an interesting impact of that. And I'm curious at the state, like statewide, like how that's evolved, you know, like how Georgia's become a little bit more purple blue. Like what are your feelings on that? And also like, what is it really like on the ground?
Yeah, well, thanks for taking interest in our amazing state. You know, it's funny, we have been sort of front and center for years now. And I have to say, being in Georgia, so I grew up in the D.C. area, right? So I grew up in the D.C. area. I did my undergrad at Harvard, my law degree at Georgia State. I've been here for, you know, a minute, for 20 years or so. And to see how quickly it has shifted, right? Who could have believed 5 years ago that we would have had, you know, two Democratic senators, that we would have had a run like, you know, Stacey Abrams with a potential, you know, potentially the first Black female governor coming out of Georgia. I mean, it doesn't surprise me living here because you see that kind of burgeoning change because we're an amazing state for business and growth and also for young people moving here. So that is kind of what's, and also shifting policies, shifting ideas about what people want out of the future of their state. So on the ground, it's extremely exciting. I think having lived here, having been a part of this, it's part of what makes me want to get more involved, to be part of the change that is emerging in Georgia.
Yeah, it's all super exciting. Georgia has been exciting for a minute. So I'm just like, excited to see where it continues to go. I want to talk about like social media a little bit because we love your social media. We wanted to like also to ask kind of what a typical day in the life looks like for you. You tend to like do that type of content. So yeah. Just curious to hear like what a day in the life campaigning looks like mixed in with your personal life. Like how do you manage it all? And why does that drive your content so much?
Yes. So it's thank you for watching my content. Thanks for that kind feedback. So it's interesting. A lot of the things that are visually more interesting are not necessarily what you do in every day in the life as a candidate. So a large part of your life is, I mean, there's basically two buckets of things you do. One is fundraising and one is voter contact. And so fundraising is a lot of what's called call time. And that is literally you're on the phone talking to potential donors and all things related to that. That comprises a lot of your time as a candidate. And it's probably one of the most surprising things for first-time candidates. And definitely like, it's a little inside baseball in the sense of like, that's what you do as a candidate, because it's not very, you might not think, but until we fix our system where finances are not that as much a part of it, it is part of your responsibility as a candidate to raise funds. So showing video of me doing call time every day, I don't think is very interesting. So I try to film days now that like the campaign is picking up more, I try to film days where there's, you know, maybe a little different variety of things going on, right? And I will also say that vlogs are very hard to edit. I'm sure you guys know from podcasts, the back end is hard to edit. So that's why I've been doing more sounds and trends lately as opposed to vlogs, because they are very time intensive. And, you know, there's only so much time we have as candidates. So that's that. But that said, yeah. So my day starts pretty early. I have five kids. They get up. My younger ones are on the bus by 6:50-ish in the morning. So our day, you know, we're up by 6. We're getting at least three of those kids out the door. Then my middle schoolers get up a little bit later and we get them out of the house. So a lot of my work time is between, you know, the hours of like 8:30 and 3:15 is when the kids start coming home from school. So in between then, we're doing call time. I might do coffees with, you know, folks in the community or voters. I might have a meet and greet scheduled where, say, a mom friend in the community has organized a coffee with a few other different friends, and we're talking about issues in the community. Sometimes, you know, I will canvass during the day because it's a little bit easier for me as a candidate to do that when my kids are not on the premises. So I will often schedule my canvassing time during the day. And by canvassing, that means, you know, knocking doors, talking to voters. You have different turfs that you're doing as you're working through the district, meaning like set groups of neighborhoods that you're going to be knocking on those doors. And then in the evenings, and all this, while all this is going on, we're interacting. Like I have my campaign manager, we have different fellows, like we're all kind of interacting all day long through these things. And then like, sometimes there's other evening events. So like yesterday, for example, in the morning I had, you know, the first event of the day was a Lifting Our Jewish Voices. There's five Jewish candidates that are running in Georgia right now, which is also unprecedented. That's huge. And so there was like a panel discussion talking about the different issues kind of facing the Jewish community in particular and kind of helping the community know about our candidacies. Then I went straight from that to an Emerge event. So Emerge is a wonderful organization geared towards women who want to run for office. It actually, fun fact, was started, I believe, in conjunction with Kamala Harris's first run for presidency. I think, don't quote me on that, but I know she was one of the very first Emerge candidates. Also, our rep here in Georgia, Lucy McBath, was in one of the very first classes of Emerge. And it basically is really hands-on training for women candidates. So I was part of the Emerge signature program in Georgia in June last year. It's like a six-month program. So they had an event for their donors and several of us candidates that are running now came and kind of did a little speech and talked about how important the Emerge program was for us personally and also why it's important to invest in women candidates, which I could talk about for days. And then I went to a fundraiser that one of my friends hosted for me, and that was in conjunction with another local rep. Syra Draper was a co-host on that. And so, yeah, that was, you know, a couple hours of that. So there's speeches and meeting and greeting different folks in the community. And that was, you know, that was the day.
I mean, it's a whirlwind. I haven't gotten
that yet. But that was
honestly such a whirlwind.
It's very visual. You can kind of see all the different kinds of interactions you have as a candidate on the campaign trail.
Totally. And honestly, vlogs are so underratedly hard. We try and do them for our social too. And there's some days where I'm like, I thought I put together all these video clips. I got 3 seconds here, 3 seconds there. And it's like, oh, like literally nothing burgers. Yes. People are going to be like, what's happening? Like, if you don't know the inside baseball, you're totally at a loss for it. But like, so it's tough. Yes. It's really tough out there. Or you're so busy in the event, which is always great. Like, should be focused on it. And then therefore you miss all the content that you needed to take. Like, it is.
Right. Well, you need to have someone documenting. So like we have a campaign, we have a campaign fellow who's amazing. She's a UGA student. And so she was with us yesterday taking photographs and also getting, you know, social media footage that you can put into the vlog, because literally you can't get your video like when you're in a panel discussion, you need someone else to do it. So,
right.
But again, it's kind of like behind the scenes stuff,
B-roll
of, you know, how you make that content to come to life, but it is, you know, there's a lot that goes into it behind the scenes.
Yeah, I'm really curious about all these conversations you're having too, about just like whether it's with voters, but also donors. Like, I have many questions because first I'm just like curious, we're in this new moment politically, obviously, like with Kamala being at the top of the ticket. I'm curious how that has shifted some of your conversations and like overall interest in your campaign. So I'm just like overall curious about like national narratives that you're that are happening that like you are that are brought into the conversations you're having.
Yes. Well, that's a great question. And I think as a, you know, local, what's called down ballot candidates, maybe your, you know, viewers and listeners are familiar with that. But if they're not, you know, you have the top of the ticket up here, which would be Harris. And also at the top of the ticket, you might have in other cycles, you might have like the governor or like senators and things like that. But further down, literally down the ballot are other types of local races like mine. So that would be, you know, your state Senate, your state House reps, you know, even further down like school board and other types of races like that. And so there is always this kind of conversation of, you know, the importance of the local down ballot candidates and how much those policies impact your daily life. So, of course, there is so much energy. There's so much excitement. I personally feel so excited about Harris's candidacy. I mean, she happens to be a biracial woman. I happen to be a biracial woman. Her dad is Jamaican. My dad is Jamaican. In my case, my mom is white and Jewish. And so I really personally connect with her story of bridging all of these different cultural worlds, but also being, you know, it's really the American dream, like the story of the blending of cultures, you know, education being a foundation of your story to kind of make it in America. I personally really connect with that, and I'm very energized about it. And I'm hearing lots of people on the phone for local or national, very energized about the new top of the ticket. It's very energizing. I think part of the conversation you have as a down ballot candidate are the local issues. So for us, and I have conversations with, you know, the vast majority of our donors are from Georgia, of course. Like, I mean, well over, you know, 70-75% are from Georgia. But of course, since I've lived in other places, you know, I have friends and family who contributed to our campaign from other places. And so sometimes the conversation is, well, why should I give to a race in Georgia, right? Why should I give to a race in Georgia that's down ballot? And, you know, it's really, we're in many places where there are totally blue, you know, totally blue states, so to speak, where maybe reproductive rights are less in danger. There's more policies on the books right now where we have, you know, abortion access and abortion rights. We don't in Georgia. Georgia is one of the places where if you invest in flipping the state legislatures in a purple state or a red state, you are making a real impact on the day-to-day life of women in other places, women all across the country. So that's something that comes up a lot, especially reproductive rights access and really just supporting progressive values in places where maybe they are more at risk and where maybe they're more developing. So yeah, but that's, I hope I answered the question.
I know, 1,000%. And I think the issues too that are being discussed at the local level are so important. And they also, you know, they trickle up and they trickle down. And I think what we always say right. to people that like aren't so sure about whether it's like donating or paying attention to a race that's not in their state, it's like what happens in another state can absolutely impact you because those legislatures are going to copy and paste those policies and make them happen in your neck of the woods. So it's very much should be like on, you know, the top of people's tongues or whatnot. So I am curious, though, in terms of the like more local specific issues, like what's been coming up? Like, is it like public school? Is it vouchers? Is it, you know, the roads? Like, what are those issues that people are like, can we do something about this, please?
Yes. Well, of those, I would say reproductive rights is like the tip of the tongue for almost every person I talk to. I mean, when we're, because we're talking to voters right now that are, you know, new voters, Republicans, as well as, you know, Democrats, that's kind of like who's on the doors with us right now. And reproductive rights is definitely top of mind for folks on both sides of the aisle. But another issue that comes up a lot, because my district in particular happens to be a very strong public school district in Georgia. My kids, all five of them go to the public schools, and I'm a proud graduate of public schools myself, and I'm very supportive of public schools. So there is this voucher movement. My opponent happened to be the person who spearheaded it over the course of like a decade plus in Georgia to get that over the line. But basically, vouchers for your audience are ways that the state gives sort of a coupon to in different ways to folks in order to use tax money for private schools or homeschooling instead of that money going to the public school system. And states are kind of expanding this in different ways. In Georgia, for example, we had a specific voucher that was available for disabled students for a period of time. But in keeping with national trends, there are movements to make these more, quote, universal, meaning that any student for any reason could basically extract money from the public school system and use that to fund private or homeschool. As you can already tell, the discussion of this kind of gets into the weeds. It's sort of very technical and how does it work and, you know, what's sort of the there for the average voter who is concerned about what's the experience like for my kid at their school? Is it going to be a good school? Are they going to get the education they need? What are kind of the factors that affect how their experience is going to be affected? Are the teachers going to have the right resources? Are they going to have the pens and pencils? Are the bus drivers going to be, you know, do we have enough bus drivers for the school system? And so all of these things are really about funding. So when people talk about the public school system on the door, you know, voters are concerned. They're concerned that teachers are both, you know, having the resources they need to teach effectively in the classroom, protecting those resources. Most folks I talk to are anti-voucher when I'm talking to them on the door, and we really get into the weeds of this issue. But folks also are very concerned. Here in Georgia, we have a surplus. Okay, it's alleged surplus in the budget. Say sometimes the numbers change a little bit, but somewhere between 11 and 16 billion, I've seen different figures, surplus in the budget. But is it really a budget if we're not fully funding public schools, if we're not making sure that, you know, right now in my community, we have a bus driver shortage of 140 bus drivers? That's a lot. I mean, that is, you think about the resources needed to run the school system at in its most efficient way, and we're not doing that. And now with the voucher bill passing, we are threatening that even further. So it's a really important discussion, and I think we'll continue to have this discussion. And certainly, you know, if elected, I would be voting against vouchers and voting to expand funding for public schools.
Totally. I feel like the education funding conversation from like every job under the sun related to it is under the microscope in every state. Like I know, like the last person in my friend group that was a teacher just left teaching. And she was like, I'm over it. Like, this is getting so insane. Like, we're not being paid enough for any of the, like, the shit that we're dealing with. I'm out. And, like, I had, like, I think six across, like, my extended friend group, six teachers, and they're all out. And not even 30, like crazy. Mm. So yeah. It's like part of that has to do with like adequate resources and funding and not having to like spend all of your money buying your own pencils and pens and markers and all of those things. And I know too, you have some experience dealing with this being on the PTA. And so yeah. I'm curious how that's come into your lens and how you've viewed this issue sort of evolve and come together.
Yes. I did want to go back quickly to your point about your friends leaving the profession. And I don't know if this is perhaps the part of the reason, but I have heard other teachers share with me just the uncomfortable climate that they're in right now. I mean, in Georgia, yeah. we have this divisive concepts law, which basically seeks to control how teachers teach and what concepts they're teaching. So for example, anything that's remotely controversial, whether it is historical or has certain types of discussion about race, religion, et cetera, anything that is deemed quote unquote divisive, which by the way, from a legal perspective, that is very confusing and obscure. And how are teachers really supposed to know what is divisive? So they're operating in a climate of fear, right? They're operating in a climate of fear. And, you know, teachers are professionals. We should be trusting teachers to be able to know how to do their job in a professional way. But instead, there's additional restrictions, there's additional bureaucracy and requirements. And teachers are really living in fear. I mean, this wasn't my particular district, but you probably have seen the national news about a particular teacher in Cobb County nearby, and she was essentially fired for presenting a book that had been offered at the school book fair. She read the book to her class, and she ended up getting, you know, removed from her position. And it was obviously very controversial, but that's what teachers are kind of dealing with. They just want to come and do their job in a professional way, but they're at risk of being fired for teaching history, for sharing concepts that are very, you know, part of our normal discussion out here in the world. So it's not good.
No, it's definitely not. But I definitely think, yeah, that's a huge piece of it. It's an added layer that everyone's having to deal with on a day-to-day. And there's a point where it's like, okay, like, is this worth it? Is this, right. like, what could I be doing elsewise that would be being paid more, not having to deal with the absolutely, like, insane parent that comes in on a tirade about, like, XYZ thing. So I, you know, there has been evolution, but we hopefully will see some type of change in it. And, you know, I'm curious too, with that in mind, like, what do you think would help shift that? Like, is it a policy, like a legislative change that would move the needle there?
Yeah. Well, here in Georgia, we definitely need to repeal the Divisive Concepts Act. I mean, that is something that we should not have on the books. And I would definitely fight against that. I do think having more, you know, we need to keep having these discussions because part of these issues of, you know, history and representation, I think it's very important to have more voices in the room that are adding different perspectives in terms of all of our policymaking and also in terms of, you know, the school system. We want to make sure we're not leaving out pieces of history and beyond because we want our kids to be prepared for the real world, so to speak.
Yeah.
So PTA is I'm on the PTA at my elementary school and also my kids' middle school. And then I'm also on something called SGC, which is like a student governance council. And that is an elected position that you have within each school within Fulton County. And it helps to decide what charter funds are used for. So that's a little bit more formal, right? The PTA is a little bit more informal, but I would say all of these programs and really as it relates to even public service in general or running for office, it really is about the kids and, you know, parents take time out of their schedule, they volunteer because we all want to provide the best experience for our children. So in the school system that is in our community, I mean, if anything, you working on the PTA, you of course see how much the public school in particular is part of like the soul of the community. I mean, the events that draw folks, whether it's the school community itself, like parents at the school, teachers, you know, different businesses. This year I'm helping with, you know, fundraising for the PTA and working with business partners. And this really drives the experience and helps give kids a positive experience. Now, kind of a side note, there is, you know, PTAs and PTOs, folks may not know, a lot of times support financially different programming at the school. So there can be widely, again, going back to school funding, there can be widely disparate experiences at schools in, you know, counties where in parts of the county where there may be, you know, a wealthier school background versus parts of the county where there isn't as active, or there it's just a different kind of socioeconomic community. And, you know, schools do rely on funds from the PTA and the PTO to help support programming. So I think going back, it's a great way to kind of augment what the school is already offering, but there are some disparities. And I think that's something we need to look at when we look at what do we really want to be having the base level provisions that we can do with funding at the state level instead of necessarily depending on the PTO to augment basic services that should be provided by state level funding.
Yeah, that's actually such a great point. I remember back in the day, I'm from New Jersey originally, we'd like lose funding for something, like the PTA would step in and like help fundraise for whatever it was. Right. And then we'd like still have a band, you know, whereas like another school might be then like losing its band or gym class or whatever it might be. So I think that's a really good point. I feel like a lot of people don't know that. So love to hear the explanation.
And such valuable experience to bring to the State House. So I love that. And I just, before we wrap, I wanted to make sure that we can get all the info on your campaign and like how people can tap in. It's like kind of crunch time, which is crazy. Yes. I can't believe we're like basically entering fall. So yeah, where can people find you? Where can people get involved? Give us all the plugs.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. Yeah. So DeborahForGeorgia.com is the website. It's all spelled out. Deborah for Georgia, all spelled out. And all my socials are the same too. So Deborah for Georgia on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, I think. And I'm not as active on X. I don't know.
Us too. We respect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We refuse. We literally refuse.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep up. It's so constant. It's harder to keep up. So I once or so a day on the others, I'm very active. So yeah. So all, you know, any way folks want it. I mean, we have interns who are all over the country, literally international. We have some folks that were with us.
Oh, that's cool.
In like study abroad programs and stuff like that. So again, at this point, there are so many ways to get involved, whether it is, you know, virtually helping us out. Of course, donating makes a big difference because those resources go directly to like things like buying signs and buying, you know, walk cards that you distribute, literature, things like that. So thanks for your support.
Love it. I love the like virtual intern program too. I think that's like weirdly newer, but so impactful. If you want to get involved in a local campaign somewhere, you can do that. So love it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey guys, popping in with a reminder to sign up for the GovHub newsletter. This weekly pop of politics is designed to share action items, resources, and quick links to civic engagement tools and topics directly to your inbox. Save it, share it, and sign up for a pinch of productive politics today by going to girlonthegov.com or visiting this episode's description.